Good evening and welcome to this special Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. On today's show, we'll hear from Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund organizer Kai Hushky from Spokane, who spoke with activists in Moscow February 1st about ways to combat corporate political hegemony in communities and about a possible community bill of rights. But first, this news. The Joint Finance Appropriations Committee in the Idaho Legislature has been busy today setting public schools budgets for fiscal year 2014. Under the education budget approved by JFAC, $21 million would pay for teacher bonuses and professional development. 40% of that amount would go to professional development. School districts will decide how that money's paid out. Democratic Representative Shirley Ringo of Moscow brought up an alternative motion, which would give teachers and their associations a say in how the performance bonuses are distributed. Ringo said she wants the teachers involved with the process since the plan is not covered in collective bargaining. The alternate wording proposed by Ringo includes language right before the sentence, quote, such plan shall not be subject to collective bargaining, any other provision of the law notwithstanding. Ringo's motion failed to get the necessary votes, with only Republican Senator Dan Johnson of Lewiston joining the four Democrats on the committee voting in favor. The final count, 14-5, Republican Senator Dean Cameron of Rupert, who is co-chair of the committee, said his wording already covers what Ringo wanted inserted. The wording Rupert had put in the bill says, all plans shall be approved by the local board of trustees, including evidence that the plan was developed with input from the principal, teachers, and certified employees at each school. Cameron's wording in the measure was passed by a 15-4 vote. The final motion on the measure passed 16-3 and moves to the House and Senate. The Idaho House Education Committee today passed a measure which would give school districts power to unilaterally impose teacher contracts if they fail to reach an agreement with the local teachers union by a certain date. The bill, which advanced in committee on a party line vote, now moves to the full House for debate. According to the Idaho Statesman, the legislation is supported by the Idaho School Boards Association. The Idaho School Boards Association says schools need the measure's deadlines to give them time to evaluate and make their budgets. The legislation as written would last a year, with the expectation all parties would take a further look at the measure to see if it's working after this year's contract deadlines in June. The Idaho Education Association opposes the legislation because they say it takes away teachers' ability to negotiate contracts. School districts were given the power to impose unilateral contracts permanently under Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Luna's 2011 education overhaul laws, but that was overturned by voters in November. A measure which gives school districts the power to put teachers under investigation on unpaid administrative leave also passed in the House Education Committee today. The 13-3 vote came after a lively debate. Idaho School Boards Association Executive Director Karen Echevarria said educators under criminal investigation should not be paid. Attorney Paul Stark, representing the teachers' union, countered the legislation assumes guilt before a trial, contradicting the law. The Joint Finance Appropriations Committee yesterday approved a 3.8% increase in higher education funding for the next fiscal year. The committee appropriated $236.5 million, which is an increase of $8.6 million. The money will likely be divided among the four state colleges and universities by the State Board of Education in April. The Lewiston Tribune reports line items in the JFAC budget approved yesterday include $2.5 million in a category called occupancy costs, which pays for security, utilities, and custodial work in new college buildings. The University of Idaho asked for $221,000 in occupancy costs for the Idaho Water Center, $55,400 for the Center for Applied Fish Studies, and $6,800 for the Combustion Research Laboratory, and $12,800 for new offices and classrooms. Lewis Clark State College, did not request occupancy costs. The higher ed budget also includes $5 million for enrollment workload adjustment, which allows colleges to make changes in the number of sections of classes needed when enrollment patterns change. The budget also includes $1.1 million for benefits. In sessions today, the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee allocated $12.5 million to the deferred maintenance budgets of colleges and universities. JFAC co-chair Dean Cameron of Rupert acknowledged the money is a drop in the bucket compared to the $700 million in deferred maintenance at the University of Idaho, Boise State University, Idaho State University, and Lewis Clark State College. Cameron was quoted in the Spokesman Review saying, "I think we've all known that there was a level of deferred maintenance. We know that this doesn't solve the problem. We just didn't know how bad it was. Frankly, there are a lot of other choices that we probably should be considering, but given the constraints on the budget, given the constraints of other issues at play in this legislature, we thought this was the best approach we could take. We're grateful that we're able to take one small step forward." Under the plan, the University of Idaho, Idaho State University, and Boise State University would get $3.75 million each for deferred building maintenance, and Lewis Clark State College would get $1.25 million. In a Joint Finance Appropriations Committee session on the State Division of Welfare budget this morning, lawmakers approved just under $147,000 to restore funding for five vacant child support enforcement positions in the food stamp program. Another $147,000 for the program would come under federal matching funds. The overall welfare budget approved by the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee today is up 3.8% over last year's, with a 4.8% increase in state general funds. The budget pays for determining eligibility for Medicaid, food stamps, and other Department of Health and Welfare programs. The committee passed the budget on a 17-1 vote, with Republican Senator Cheryl Nuxall of Cottonwood voting against. According to the Spokesman Review's Eye on Boise blog, Nuxall said, "I just want to say that morally I cannot fund a budget which complies with implementing the Affordable Care Act." The Joint Finance Appropriations Committee also voted 17-1 today to spend $477.5 million in state money for Medicaid, up 0.7% from last year. The total Medicaid budget for Idaho, including federal funds, is expected to be $2.024 billion next year. The budget includes $5 million in state general funds allocated for new cases expected when people who have been eligible for Medicaid enroll in the program for the first time. The federal government will pay $12.4 million for that part of the program. Republican Senator Cheryl Nuxall of Cottonwood was the one no vote. Nuxall said it is implementing the Affordable Care Act because of the individual mandate at a tremendous price. The Senate Local Government and Taxation Committee unanimously voted in favor of a bill yesterday that clarifies that tribal land on reservations is exempt from property taxes. Benoit County Prosecutor Doug Payne opposed the measure because the county has been taxing tribal land within the county. Payne told the committee, "The tribal government is not just a government. The tribal government is also a business, big business. Half of Benoit County is in the boundaries of the Coeur d'Alene Indian Reservation." The bill passed in the House earlier on a 64-3 vote and now moves to the full Senate. District 6 lawmakers, Senator Dan Schmidt and Representative Shirley Ringo, have scheduled three open House meetings with constituents in the area tomorrow. The two lawmakers will be at the Potlatch Library at 9 a.m., at the Filling Station Cafe in Troy at 11 a.m., and at the Senior Center at 140 East Walnut Street in Genesee at 2 p.m. Again, those meetings are tomorrow. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals yesterday sent a lawsuit by Boise homeless people back to U.S. District Court in Boise for reconsideration as to whether the city's ordinances against public sleeping and camping are unconstitutional. Idaho legal aid and attorney Howard Belladoff are representing 8 homeless Boise residents who say the law criminalizes homelessness because shelters are often full in the city. The Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks reports the Yellowstone elk herd is now just over 3,900 animals, down from 20,000 in 1992. The department says introduced gray wolves have had a big impact on culling the herd, but other predators, harsh winters, and hunting are also factors in reducing the herds. Albion Mayor Randy Crowner says the city is implementing new record-keeping policies and procedures after a recent state accountability audit revealed several sets of missing public records. The Washington State Auditor's Office conducted the audit late last year, examining the town records from 2008 to 2011. The report says Albion staff could not locate town council meeting minutes and resolutions and ordinances from 11 meetings held during the audit period. Copies of annual budget ordinances from 2008 and 2009 were also missing, as well as documents of the council's approval of claims and payroll for a total of 15 months. Crowner said an employee is accused of deleting the records before she left her job. He said the employee is not suspected of anything other than improperly deleting records. Crowner said the town is not facing any sanctions as a result of the findings, but is working to implement safeguards to prevent it from happening again. The Washington House yesterday approved a bill that would tap the marijuana tax revenue to expand early learning programs. Democratic Representative Ruth Kagi of Lake Forest Park said she couldn't think of a better use for the money, while Republican Representative Gary Alexander of Olympia said he would prefer to see the money come into the general fund and then be prioritized along with all other expenses. Alexander argued it's too early to be dedicating the money when the amount of money is still unknown. Marijuana remains illegal under federal law, and federal officials have not yet decided whether to try to block implementation of Washington's legalization laws. The bill now goes to the Senate. Unless Congress comes up with a deal after the $1.2 trillion budget cuts spread over the next 9 years, also known as the sequester, the three federal programs that would see the deepest cuts would be academic support for poverty-stricken students, special education funding under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, and Title IIA. Lewiston School District Superintendent says the district stands to lose $100,000 from the cuts. Most school districts in the region will probably lose some of their special education funding. Moscow School District is expecting to lose up to $24,000 in special education funding, and the Orofino and Mountain View School Districts could lose about $12,000 each in special education funding. We now turn to our featured segment. Spokane organizer for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, Kai Hushke, spoke to a group in Moscow February 1st about what communities can do to combat overwhelming corporate power and the possibility of enacting community bills of rights. Here's a portion of that talk by Kai Hushke.
The reframing part is really to get away from, as I mentioned at the beginning, this idea of single issues. Because the problem is when we operate under single issues, there's always going to be the next single issue. So again, if we stay in the food world, it's GMOs today, it could be XYZs tomorrow, it could be God knows what. There's always the next thing that's going to come, because before GMOs, it was factory farms. It's still sort of factory farms. In essence, we've given up in large degree on saying no to factory farms, and now we're trying to do our best to make sure that the factory farms operate in a more humane way or a less destructive way. And we've seen how well that's worked. In fact, there was something that came out not too long ago where the EPA says they're going to stop doing, you know, monitoring of factory farms because they don't have the resources anymore to do it. So it's always going to be, there's always something else around the corner. And when we operate and organize around the issue itself, in essence, we're avoiding the decision-making structure itself. Okay? So it's about getting out from underneath that. And it doesn't diminish the idea that we want this kind of stuff. It's not to say we don't want a sustainable food system, or sustainable energy system, or sustainable healthcare system, or sustainable economy. But it's getting to the understanding that it's not the issue that we're facing, or that's the bigger threat here. It's actually the system of decision making that's the bigger threat. So though we have issue problems, the bigger problem really is this idea that we have a democracy problem. We have a decision making problem. In essence, the majority is not being heard. On the community level, it's, we don't have decision making power over these things that we believe we should have decision making power. And so it's about getting out from underneath the frame of the issue and reframing it up and actually what we're after. The good thing is we're not the first people to begin to start thinking this way, whether it's the folks here tonight or whether it's the folks in the communities that we've been working with on the particular quote-unquote issue, because other people's movements have to do the same thing. And when I say people's movements specifically, I'm more referencing the abolitionists and the suffragists. Because when you look at the basics of the structure of law, and you look at the viewpoint of where the remedy sits at those points in time, there was no remedy if you were a black person in this country at the time of abolition. In fact, you were property under the law. You weren't even seen as a person. There was no murder of a slave. It was property damage that was paid to the slave owner. The same way with women under the law. Women, in essence, were property of their husband. They were not seen as people under the law. So in essence, the structure itself didn't validate them. There was no remedy. They weren't seen under that particular structure of law. Yet they were told that they had to abide the law, where they weren't even recognized under. Okay? So in essence, those folks understood that the structure itself is where we'd have to go towards. It wasn't setting up a Slavery Protection Act. It was about getting rid of slavery because the system itself is validating or making slavery legal. Again, you go back to the Constitution. It was constitutionalized. We weren't supposed to touch, Congress wasn't allowed to touch slavery until 1808, at the time it was, you know, ratified. So, you know, we have not only was it an economic document, but it initially started out as a slave document. So the abolitionists, the suffragists understood we have a structural problem. I use that word a lot, but I can't think of a better word. We have a structural problem here. The structure of law doesn't recognize us. When we start to look at our communities, and we look again at those four hammers, Dillon's rule, preemption, constitutional rights with commerce clause or personhood rights, in essence, our communities aren't being recognized by that structure of law. We've been subordinated, we've been colonized, we've been pushed to the side, much in the same way that suffragists, much in the same way that abolitionists also were not seen, or not the abolitionists so much themselves, but obviously black Americans were seen at that time. And so the understanding is we've got a structural problem. So it was reframing things differently to get out from underneath, in our case, our litany of our issues that we're dealing with, to understand we actually have to go after the structure. Once they understood that and started working in that way, their viewpoint of the so-called law also changed. And it's things I think a lot of us admire and think about today when we think about those periods of history. And some of those elements are true today around how these things build. What they represented really were that those folks in a lot of cases end up breaking the law. In essence, they were disobedient to a law that didn't recognize them. And when they did so, they did it openly, they did it frontally, and they did it unapologetically. They didn't apologize for breaking the law because they understood that the law wasn't about them. And so we talked about the civil rights movement and things did then. You know, people like Susan B. Anthony going to vote, which was against the law, and getting arrested, using the courtroom to, the stand, in essence, to make her plea around, we need to think differently around this idea of women's suffrage. Our communities, in a lot of ways, are in the same place. So it wasn't our turn, but someone had gone through one of these democracy schools after going through it and sort of making these connections, connecting the dots, so on and so forth. You know, her description of what's happening at the community level now is that what we have here is collective nonviolent civil disobedience through local lawmaking. In a lot of ways, it's very true because it's about frontally going after some of these legal hammers to say we no longer see these as legitimate. In fact, the so-called legal stuff in a lot of cases is the illegitimate stuff. We have to actually drive something new forward through lawmaking that actually institutes something legitimate, much in the same way that the abolitionists were saying that black Americans need to be seen as persons under the law, that women should have the same rights as men under the law, and should access, you know, to voting privileges, you know, the idea of suffrage. Communities are running into that same sort of conclusion and mobilizing in that different way. So again, it's the reframing stuff, reframing what the fight is. And within that, I think there's this element of refusal. So in essence, all these movements all had elements of high civil disobedience to them, because that's how movements build. And what are movements about? Movements are about instituting rights. So in essence, when someone's being violated or being oppressed, it's about actually elevating those who are being victimized by it to actually be seen in a different way under the structure itself. I mean, that's what movements are about. So in a lot of ways, we've never had an environmental movement. We call it the environmental movement. We've been never really advocated for the environment from a rights-based standpoint. And we can talk about it later, but a lot of what the laws that we do, we help communities with now, actually have a rights of nature provision in them. So in essence, it's about moving nature out from this property viewpoint under the law to that actually of having rights. And believe it or not, the first communities to do so were in rural Pennsylvania, these communities that were seeing the factory farming. These are people that belong to the NRA. These are people who vote mostly the Republican. These are people that, you know, on paper, perhaps folks in this room and others, you know, may have difficulty wanting to talk to these folks. But believe it or not, these are the people at the front end of this sort of new move to look at nature differently, which is actually viewing it as having rights. And in fact, that's spread now to other parts of the world. So you have places like the country of Ecuador that constitutionally see nature as having rights, no longer as having property, but ecosystems that have rights that need to be protected. When who has to protect it? Well, it still has to be left up to people to do so. And so you have this shifting going on, this reframing, this refusing, and in essence, the rights of nature is really a reengineering of what the law should be about when it comes to environmental protections. And so it really is taking aim at using the outlets that we have. And you mentioned at the beginning that, you know, the federal level is in essence closed to us. It's closed for business to the people. I think in a lot of ways you can say that at the state. So where do you go with it? Well, where people are going currently is they're going to their local level, because it's easier. You have accessibility to your municipal government, whether it's the city or the county, to actually do this kind of stuff. So in essence, to set the stones or make the blueprints for what is possible. And this is what is happening in the communities that we've been working with. Initially, it started with factory farming. So the first sort of viewpoint was, well, we have to get corporations out of farming. So in essence, we have to get big agribusiness out of farming. So there was this almost paradigm shift to say it's not about the factory farms, but this idea that the corporate entity is actually dictating what farming looks like in our community. And that's really the deeper fundamental problem here. So we have to pass laws that remove that, invalidate the family farm stuff, invalidate the big agribusiness, the big business stuff. There's been an evolution of this stuff within the different issue areas that we've worked in about what else these sort of local laws need to contain, and eventually they've come to be known as community bills of rights. These sit at the core of these particular ordinances, and these are about communities themselves advocating for certain rights. Most of it is around environmental stuff. So it's usually around clean air and clean water, the actual right to clean air and clean water, the rights to natural communities, in essence, the rights for those natural ecosystems to exist. And then there's usually some sort of a prohibition to say that a certain practice doesn't fit within the rights that we're actually trying to advocate for, therefore it cannot be allowed to actually take place anymore in our community. Whether it's saying no to factory farms, so prohibition to factory farms, no to fracking, no to corporate water withdrawal. So we've got communities in the Northeast that have passed laws that say no to corporations coming in and siphoning off the water from their aquifer. On the energy front, besides fracking, we've got communities in the Northeast that have said no to large hydroelectric industry out of Canada, wants to run major transmission lines through a lot of forested areas in New England, in essence wiping out forest ecosystems. The corporations, in essence, using things like eminent domain to actually grab public lands for their own corporate pursuits. And these communities, like in all these other issue areas, when they start to look at the system itself or the structure itself, they found out that structure is not theirs. It's been built and it benefits somebody else. And we actually have to put a new structure law in place that actually advocates for what we want and challenges this notion that the corporations can come in and dictate what our communities are going to look like. So in essence, it's revolting against It's revolting against that structure of law, and it's doing so by seizing their own local governments to make new lawmaking to actually make that case. And so it's trying to use the most powerful level that it lever it has for itself to do so. So in some ways, it's also evolving from the learnings of past people's movements. And so it's not just about, you know, putting ourselves in front of the coal train or the megalodes or whatever it is. We may still need to continue to do that stuff. But it's understanding we have to get out from underneath that stuff and actually use the system of law to actually do the advocating for what we want to see happen. And a lot of that's built, again, on the Declaration of Independence or this notion that all political power is inherent in the people. And this notion of governments are supposed to be about people and for people, and if they no longer operate that anymore, then it's our right to alter or abolish it. It's actually practicing that. It's not just being amazed by it to read about it from the late 1700s or to go to your state constitution occasionally and read those words. It's actually living it. And that's what these communities are doing, is saying, well, this system isn't working for us. We actually have to live these words, and we have to put something in place that advocates even for something bigger than that. And I think the rights of nature piece is one of those kinds of things. And so where is this stuff leading to sort of conclude? And then I'm happy to take as many questions as folks want to kind of throw out there. Is the understanding is it doesn't just stop at the boundaries, let's say, of Moscow or the boundaries of Latah County, but this stuff eventually has to build to a higher level. And again, much like those past people's movements, it started small, it started local, and they eventually were able to stitch things together to have enough pressure to make the changes that they needed to do at the higher levels. And so what's starting to happen in a few places, including Washington State, is the beginnings of these statewide coalitions, these statewide movements to make these structural changes at the state constitutional level. If we go back for a second to those four hammers, when you look at Dillon's rule and preemption, those are state-controlled issues. So in essence, you can wipe out two of the hammers if you reoriented what the state is supposed to do in relation to the local. So you can get rid of Dillon's rule through changes at the state level. You can reorient what preemption means at the state level. So some of these things we can take care of if we do so at the state level. Other things like the Commerce Clause, Contracts Clause, and the civil rights protections for corporations, those eventually have to make themselves all the way up to the federal level. But like people's movements, they all built locally. Women's suffrage, for instance, there were a number of states, of course, that passed women's suffrage before the federal government did. So again, we have precedents for this kind of stuff. So Washington is moving towards this. New Hampshire, New Mexico, the furthest along is the state of Pennsylvania. They're starting to build chapters now that eventually will build towards actually calling for state constitutional change. Some of the things that are floating out there is this idea that there's this right to local self-government. I haven't hammered that home very hard tonight, but in some of these communities that we've worked in, specifically around things like land-applied sewage sludge and factory farmings, about 100 so communities started passing these sort of anti-agribusiness laws at their local level to keep these corporate threats out. And what the corporate industry lobbyists will do is once they get tired of trying to fight you one-on-one at the local level, they'll go to the state because the state is there, again, their insulator for what they want to do. And what do they do? Well, they pass new state legislation. There's that preemption thing that comes into play. In Pennsylvania, what they ended up passing is this law that basically put communities in the position that all the local laws they did pass in order to protect their communities would be nullified. They added an additional element, which you're starting to see in other kinds of laws as well, that it no longer was about a private entity like a corporation picking up the law to then sue a municipality for having a law that the state says they can't have. They actually put the state attorney general in a position to sue the municipality on behalf of the corporation. So in essence, if I'm the corporate industry, and this community has what I see as an anti-corporate farming law in place that has been put in place to keep corporate factory farming out of that particular community, I can call up the Attorney General's office in the state of Pennsylvania to say, hey, there's this law in place at the local level. You have to do something about it. So me, the corporation, I don't even have to use my own attorneys anymore if I don't want to or make the expenditures to actually go after suing the municipality. In this case, the Attorney General of this state, okay, the Attorney General whose salary is paid by members of the community that may have this law in place that's supposed to be keeping out what they see as a threat, coming into your community and suing you to overturn the law that was about trying to protect your community. So in this case, your own state comes after you, not the corporation directly, but the state. So this is how the preemption stuff works, to come after you at the community level. Okay? And to kind of give some encouraging story behind how that's worked in places in Pennsylvania about this reframing and refusing part. In one of these communities, the assistant attorney general had come in to one of these communities that had an anti-agribusiness corporate farming law in place to tell them you have to rescind your law because this is what happens. We'll sue you if you don't take your law away. And folks in that particular town meeting, of which this attorney general, assistant attorney general had come into, they heard him out for his pitch about what they needed to do, and they said, well, thank you very much. We like the law the way it is, and they escorted the assistant attorney general out of their community. These people had run up against that structure, those hammers, enough to say that system is not ours, and in essence, we refuse to obey that system. And in fact, that same community, the week later, I think, put something on their docket to actually put a new law in place that said we don't recognize the authority of the state attorney general. So, I mean, this is where this stuff is kind of elevated in these particular places that have been the most violated by the extraction-type industry and economy that we have.
That was Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund organizer Kai Hushky of Spokane speaking with activists at the 1912 Center in Moscow February 1st about a possible community bill of rights and ways to combat corporate political hegemony in communities. That's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, be sure to become a member of Radio Free Moscow and also go to the KRFP Real Radio Dinner Saturday, March 23rd at the 1912 Center. There'll be silent and live auctions, announcement of the winners of the KRFP logo design contest, and food catered by Lads of Moscow. Jim Roach and Patrick McDonald assisted with tonight's newscast. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a great weekend.